You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's storytelling on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, you can sound human, you can look human, but what happens when you take a hard look inside and realize you're missing something? That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as police departments around the country and in Wisconsin grapple with the challenge of building trust between officers and the communities they serve, particularly minority communities, some law enforcement officials are turning to the city of Darlington in southwestern Wisconsin.
Sergeant Tony Rezga recently spoke at the 21st Century Policing Conference at UW-Platteville about the unique efforts he took to build trust and understanding in the city of Darlington. When a company called Mexican Cheese Producers came to Darlington about 15 years ago, a substantial influx of new Latino residents followed.
As the community faced new struggles centered around race and culture, Rezga instituted an open-door policy for Latinos. He helped foster community events, helped arrange oil changes for Spanish speakers, and started a Latino basketball team. Rezga says building a relationship of trust is ongoing, but it's one that can pay off when it comes to fighting and solving crime.
Sergeant Tony Rezga joins us now. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department. In 2010, he received the Police Officer of the Year Award from the 3rd District of the American Legion for his work in the community with the growing Hispanic population in Darlington and southwestern Wisconsin. Sergeant Rezga, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, when Mexican cheese producers came to town 15 years ago to Darlington, what changed?
Well, we started seeing a great influx of Hispanics coming to our area for opportunities for work, not only at Mexican cheese, but also within the dairy farms. And so we started seeing a lot of migration into the city.
And at that time, what kinds of struggles were you seeing as the maybe the residents who had already been there, I'm assuming presumably white residents, and the new Hispanic residents came together?
Well, there was definitely conflicts. I mean, and none of that has completely ended, and I don't think that anybody could safely ever say that it will completely end. But what we were seeing is we were seeing conflicts between the cultures, and that is kind of what drove me to step in and hope to help curb some of those conflicts and bridge some of those gaps.
And tell us a little bit about what you did at that point. You didn't have necessarily any training for this sort of situation, but you did try some things that were new. What did you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, no actual training, but I did grow up in an immigrant family. My father was a immigrant from Mexico, and so I got to see firsthand the struggles that my father faced and our family faced through the different systems that were in place. So when I was here, being here in Darlington gave me a unique opportunity to help serve that community that was moving in quite at a rapid pace, and then serve the community that was already here. So some of the, things that I started popping in my head was just to get Hispanics involved in the community so they could be more part of the community and in fact claim ownership in their community. So some of the things that I did, I mean, the initial things, like people talk about the basketball team that I formed, well, that was simply to curb some issues that I was seeing in the bars with bar fights and things like that. There was a league, a city league, and some of the bars that members attended those city leagues. So forming the basketball team was just a way to get people to meet the Hispanics, and that in return kind of helped curb some of those tensions in the bars, some of those racial tensions. And after I saw that there was some positive there, I thought, well, I think I'm onto something here.
I'm really curious about what that was like in the beginning, especially with this basketball team. You told me a little bit of this earlier when we spoke, and it sounds like the guys from the bars who were not used to seeing Hispanics in their bars became,
yeah.
They started to accept the Latinos who were there to play, and something new transpired between them. What were those first games like?
Yeah, well, the first games obviously were kind of new because Hispanics traditionally don't, perform, play basketball. I mean, there is basketball in Latin American countries and things like that, but the reality is that it's not a top sport. So getting the Hispanics convinced to participate was a chore. But I think that those original people actually saw it as an advantage to the bigger picture. And I don't think we ever won a game. I mean, it wasn't for that. I participated myself so they could see that I could be part of that group and kind of mesh that bridge, you know, kind of build that bridge between the two. And then what I started to see was more of the Caucasians become friends with these people and with Hispanics and with whatever other ethnicity started joining us. You know, because there are different cultures that we've experienced just here in Darlington. We've had people from Peru. We've had people from Honduras. We have people from Mexico, which all have different cultures and all have different customs. And that kind of just started meshing together. And it slowly but surely solved that some of those issues, those tensions in the bars.
We're talking right now with Sergeant Tony Rezga. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department in southwestern Wisconsin. And he's been speaking lately about what he helped to do in Darlington, which is forming this positive relationship between police and, at the time, Hispanic community, Latino community, adding more people to that umbrella over the years in Darlington there. And you mentioned that your father was an immigrant. He'd been deported several times when you were younger. How did that experience inform your approach in Darlington?
It was very difficult for us when I was a child. My father was actually deported 39 times. We used to live in Texas, so it was a lot different than up here in Wisconsin. And the times were different in the 70s. It was just different times. So the very difficult times. Every time he was deported, and he was our primary source of income. So waiting, you know, and hoping that he'd be able to come back and those kind of things. My mother is an American citizen, and obviously we were, but we were a family of five, and we depended on his ability to work and support us. So those times were very difficult. So I got to see firsthand the system at play and what that did to families.
Did you ever get pushback within your own ranks, the police ranks, for maybe going outside the box with this? I mean, I know, for instance, one of the things you did was you brought in a lawyer to talk to the Hispanic community about immigration issues. Did anyone ever say, you know what, this is too much?
No. Actually, that's probably been the main help that has contributed to the success, I guess, in Darlington. Is we have not gotten back blow from, especially from our department. The good thing is that we've had a strong leadership throughout, and I think they recognized that, you know, barring people's personal emotions and personal feelings towards immigration and those things, we have a fundamental right to serve all people within our city and within our country. And I think that's where we strive. And I think that's what's helped us here in Darlington be successful. So, no, I didn't get much back blow that way. I also, you know, was given some freedoms, especially as I began to take on this role. Initially, you know, I was a night officer, so I didn't have a lot of recourse. But as I began to promote throughout the department and become a supervisor and having a younger supervisor myself, we were able to be forward thinkers and think a little bit ahead of times and be proactive with the population and the people in general.
Now, I know that you've been approached sometimes by other police forces who say, I want what you have there in Darlington. What's the secret recipe? What do you tell them?
Well, and that, especially now, it seems that within the last month or so, I've really been receiving a lot of attention because of the conference at UW-Platteville. But the reality is that there is no secret recipe. I've gone to several communities to speak where they've, you know, have some issues, and the main issue, I would say, is trust. And I honestly believe that just like Chief Noble Ray stated at the conference, that trust is a journey that there's never an end to. You really can never get to the end of that. You can never actually reach that journey. And the reality is that's the truth. It's a very cumbersome thing, and trust is I gain trust the same way I lose trust. One day you're helping someone, and the next day you may have to effect an arrest on a family member, and all of a sudden you've lost everybody that you've built trust with for months or even years. The key is being fair, being consistent, keeping your ducks in a row, and being honest with people, even though that honesty may not be what they wanted to hear.
We're talking right now with Sergeant Tony Rezga. He's a 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department in southwestern Wisconsin, and he's credited with helping to build a positive relationship between police and the Hispanic community over the years in Darlington.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're from the Darlington area, have you seen this in action? How has it influenced the community there? And for people around the state, have you seen similar efforts to build bridges between the locals and the new immigrant community, whether that's from Latin America, Southeast Asia, or wherever in the world? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Police Sergeant Tony Rezga is with us now. He's a 16-year veteran with the Darlington Police Department. That's in southwestern Wisconsin. And he's joining us to talk about his work building trust between the police force and the community it serves.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you yourself are from Darlington or that area, have you seen this approach at work? How have things changed for better? What could still be done? And for people anywhere in the state, what do you see happening for better or worse, building police community relationships, especially with minority communities? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Sergeant Rezga, you've said that you're always preparing for the day that a police-involved shooting happens. So how do you prepare for something like that?
Well, I don't think you can prepare actually for the event, but what I prepare for is this community support. I think that's key. I pray to God that never occurs here, but the reality is that, you know, some situations require fast acting decisions and quick thought and relying on training and those kind of things. But when it's all said and done, I mean, it's never easy on any side when somebody has to take someone's life or injure someone or anything like that, especially if you're a police officer who, you know, goes to work to do a job. And that's one of the things with police is we are here to do a job, a function in the community. And so that's a big responsibility. And I mean, there is obviously on the other side, I mean, you're having to deal with family members and community leaders and those kind of things. So I think strengthening your relationship with your community can prepare you for those things, how to better serve that community in case something like this happens, so you can hear the other side. And since you've had a strong working relationship with them, there won't be a lot of blame game going on. There will be more of how can we make sure this doesn't happen again. We've done this, but we can do this and we can do that. And so that's kind of where I say I prepare. And we're very proactive here, trying to build a relationship, a positive relationship. Like I said, building trust is not that easy. You know, like you said earlier, talking to communities that basically call me and want some kind of outline on how to go about doing that. It isn't written anywhere. And the reality is what works in one community may not work in another. But what has worked for us is patience and determination and passion. I have a passion to serve the people, and I have a patience to serve the people. And my whole goal is to serve. So I work in many facets, not only the police department, as a service-based individual. You got to find those individuals to help build that relationship and trust within the community. Like I said, there, I mean, you could find people within the community that do not like me and probably do not trust me. I'm still working on those people. And the thoughts are to always be working toward building that trust and being open-minded about it and being able to accept that maybe some of the things that you've tried didn't work and now you've got to change it, but actually listening to the community.
Do you have any advice for police departments that are struggling with this? I'm thinking of some of the tensions that boiled over in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood, and not just there, but around the country. I know you say it's individual and it takes passion, but are there any specific things that someone could do if they wanted to get going on this right now?
I think finding the person that is passionate about it, and not, it doesn't necessarily need to be someone. I mean, I've been asked, you know, do we need to hire a Hispanic officer? Do we need to hire, you know, somebody who speaks Spanish or someone? No, I don't think that that's the answer. I don't think you necessarily need to have a Hispanic officer patrolling Hispanic people. I don't know if that, I mean, to me, that doesn't make the most sense because there aren't a whole lot of Hispanic officers. In Southwest Wisconsin, I don't think there's any but myself. But so I don't think that that's the solution. I honestly think that the solution is to find someone who's passionate to be involved and who truly understands community-oriented policing, which means what is in the best interest of the community as a whole. I've always kind of, as a law enforcement officer, and especially into my later years, probably within the last decade, I have really set my mind to believe in the 97% to 3% rule. And what I mean by that is 97% of the populations, and I don't care what population you're talking about, any type of people in any type of profession, are good people that sometimes make mistakes. 3% of the population are just wired wrong, and I think those are the population that, you know, law enforcement needs to deal with. So the key for me has been not to treat the 97% of the people as 3% of the people, to treat
Sergeant Rezga, thank you so much for joining us. That was Sergeant Tony Rezga, 16-year veteran of the Darlington Police Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin tells us about a proposed bill that would address price hikes for essential prescription drugs.
First, losing a job can be scary. And in the midst of the Great Recession, plenty of Americans were struggling with unemployment and covering the cost of living. According to our next guest, money isn't the only thing that becomes a top concern after a job loss. One of the biggest challenges that can come with unemployment is a challenge to your identity and how you see your role in the world.
Joining us now is Dawn R. Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse, and her recent book is called Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Dawn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So in your book, you look at identity and mental health problems that can be related to unemployment. Can you take us through what happens when a person loses their job?
Well, a variety of things can happen, and some of them actually occur prior to losing one's job. One of the things that happens is that people don't feel like they are the same person anymore. That sense of stability of who they are starts to crumble when they no longer have their jobs. In the U.S., who we are is largely based on what we do for a living. One of the first things that people ask us is, what do you do? And we have multiple identities, multiple roles, but a big piece of that is our job. When we lose that sense of stability and we become confused about who we are. One of the most harmful things that can happen, that can harm our mental health, is that loss of identity.
And talking about that term identity, we throw that word around a lot, but in terms of your job, what other words can you use for that? Is part of it a sense of status?
It can be. A sense of prestige is part of it. It can be a sense of who you are, let's say, as a man. For example, men often feel like their job makes them the breadwinner, mm-hmm. and that's a very important thing to many men. In sociology, we tend to think of having multiple identities. There's not just one. We have many identities, and they're often based on our roles, our positions in society, things like being a parent, or an author, or an athlete, or an employee.
And something you focus on in your book is identity mismatches that can happen after job loss. What do you mean by that?
This is when the meaning of one of your identities tends to conflict with the meaning of another identity. So, for example, if the meaning of man is breadwinner and you lose your job, all of a sudden the meaning of unemployed doesn't match with man, and you start to have mental health issues.
And what other emotional challenges can happen when there's that kind of a mismatch? Is part of that going from feeling useful and like you're doing something worthwhile for those 8 or 9 hours a day, and then all of a sudden there's that void?
That's certainly one part of it. What my book focused on went beyond that, that people talked about not being the same person anymore or not getting feedback from other people that they were who they thought they were. For example, one of the people in my book named, I call her Cindy, she's a 62-year-old award-winning account executive in the travel industry. And after the Great Recession, or during the Great Recession, mergers happened. Companies were trying to desperately gain that profit margin and succeed. The merger occurred with the travel company she worked for. And as a result of that merger, they laid many people off, and she was kept on, but she got a new boss. This new boss was younger than her by a couple of decades. And as she was positioned into the new role, her age became a focus for her. She felt that her age of 62 did not match what was expected in the company because she was surrounded by younger people. Additionally, this new younger boss kept telling her, well, you just don't get it. I just don't know why you're just not getting it. Hmm. And eventually she was so concerned that she was having some form of dementia that she went to get tested. She went to a psychologist to be tested to see if she had dementia. She did not. In fact, the requirements they were putting on her were so severe that she found out after she left her job, after she lost her job, she found out that other people were fudging their numbers, that nobody could achieve the requirements that this new boss had put on them. Nevertheless, she interpreted this as being about her age, that her age didn't match her job. And I heard this echoed through several participants.
Are there particular fields where you think there is more of a risk of when there is a loss of employment that the people who are now unemployed have more serious challenges with identity and mental health issues? Do you see some sectors where that's more prevalent?
I think it would depend on a number of things. That's a good question. I think that in the tech industry, if you're a little bit older, for example, I have a brother-in-law who is in his 40s and he works for a tech company. He sometimes talks about being the old guy around and that mismatch might be there for him. Beyond that, I think that certainly white-collar jobs, people are training for many, many years to be able to get into those positions, whether it's a college degree or professional training. And when you've put so much of your life into, the length of your life into a job, it can become an even stronger part of your identity. That being said, I wouldn't say that working class jobs don't bring a sense of identity. I think they do, but in a different way.
We're talking with Dawn Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, and we're discussing her recent book, which is Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Now, I wonder, Dawn, if it's something that you got a chance to look at in your research. I can see that if you've been in a career for a long time, that's a big part of your identity, but does it change at all if you've kind of hopped from job to job, or if you've been in one company and lose that company and all the people that come with it? Is that an even more severe loss to deal with?
I think if you are not in one particular position for a long time, it actually makes it easier. The longer we're in a particular role, such as a job, the more ingrained it becomes for who we are. We enact that job every day. We enact that role every day. We act with other people every day who give us feedback that we are the person we think we are. So if you're hopping around from job to job, that might be very disorienting. It might make you feel very unstable and harm your mental health in those ways. But it probably would not harm your identity as much as being in a job for a long time.
So maybe in some ways, if you've moved around a lot, if your career has been a little more dynamic or has had changes kind of a constant to it, maybe you've developed some different skills for dealing with what is a very significant change going from employed to unemployed.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a more flexible batch of skills, a more flexible identity, you can quickly make these shifts, which is one of the strategies I describe in my book. That can help.
And you've done research with middle class people specifically who lost their jobs. What did you hear from them about what their biggest concerns were when they lost their employment?
Well, one of the things I expected to hear was that they were frightened about their finances, but that was not the number one thing. In fact, most of them didn't mention their financial status at all. They independently brought up that their identity, who they were, was threatened. One of the biggest factors was for men, again, they described themselves in ways that were very negative. They said, oh gosh, society is going to think I'm a slug, or they described themselves as being impotent. There was some very gendered language being used there. They were very, very afraid, very scared of what society would think of them and what for many of them, their wives would think of them. So who they were, how they would become that person again that they once were, their selves were really at risk here.
Do you have a sense of how people that fall on either side of the middle class, so higher earners and lower economic status people, how that differs for those groups?
I would suspect, and again, I haven't done research on the working class or lower income earners. I'd love to do that in the future. I think it might look a little different. For one, when your financial status is the most important thing, and you know, when you're working class or earning low income, you just don't have that buffer. So losing your job, the very first thing you're going to think is, oh my gosh, I don't have a job. How am I going to pay my bills? How am I going to feed my kids? Nevertheless, your identity still comes into play, I think, a little bit differently. For example, hey, I was always a union man and now I'm not. Or hey, I'm, you know, me and these women at this diner, we're servers, we're waitresses, we're a group, we're together, and oh my gosh, now we're not. So it might look a little bit different, and the financial concerns might come to the surface more.
We're talking with Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse, about her studies of how job loss affects mental health and senses of identity.
And we want to hear from you. Did leaving a job impact your mental or your emotional health? Did it influence how you saw yourself and your role in life? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can tell us if your job and what you do for a living is a big part of your identity. Call 800-642-1234.
And we continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up the conversation with Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse. And we're talking about how losing a job can impact identity and mental health.
And we want to hear from you. Has leaving a job ever impacted your relationships, either at home or with your friends? Were you one of the many people that lost their job during the Great Recession? And if so, how did you cope with that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you had to rebuild your identity or learn to see yourself differently after becoming unemployed. Or maybe did losing your job end up being a good thing in the long run? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, we just asked people, Dawn, about how it might have affected relationships, and you've touched a little bit on the relationship with a spouse, especially for a man who might really identify as being a breadwinner. What do you see in women who lose their jobs and how that might affect their relationship with their family?
It really varies. Some of them went through separations because of the stress on their own identities. and as well as some of the economic stress. Women in general, I found, were a little bit more resilient, and one of the reasons was that some of them felt they could, what I call, shift to a different identity. Many of them shifted to emphasize the mother identity. So, for example, a 41-year-old chief financial officer, who I'll call Charlotte, had told me that throughout her life, she had seen herself as the breadwinner, and she was the sole breadwinner for her family of three. Her husband was a stay-at-home father, and he took care of their two young children. She said, "Thank God I have this set up where my husband takes care of the kids, because if it were me, it would be really messed up." Always saw herself as an employee, and then she lost her job. And it was very stressful for her. She said she didn't know who she was anymore. But within a matter of a few months, she had shifted her emphasis to say, "You know what? I'm a really good mother. And you know what? If I have a bad day, I can just make egg cartons, caterpillars out of egg cartons," I think is what she said. "And I can be super mom." And her whole attitude had shifted. Women were able to do this a lot better than men. Mm-hmm. When men described trying to shift to a father role, and many of them tried, they tried to say, "I'll just be a father." They said, "Well, anybody can be a father." So one man even described it, "Well, to be a father, you just need to be a sperm donor."
I'm thinking, as you're talking about how people transition to retirement, and for some people it can be a very difficult transition because their identity has been their working life for so long. But I'm wondering if you see a difference between assuming that retirement is chosen or at least planned for or at least anticipated, if there's a difference between that and losing your job.
Absolutely. The voluntary or involuntary nature of any transition like this makes a big difference. When we choose to do something, first of all, we have control. And control over our circumstances is one of the most important factors for mental health as well. But certainly when it comes to jobs, if it's involuntary, we don't have time to prepare for how will we handle this new circumstance. Who will I become now? And if you don't have that time to prepare, you're thrown into it. You can fall into what I call identity void, this loss of all sense of self. One of the people I spoke to described that as being like you're dead and nobody told you.
Let's go to the phones and bring on Mark, who's in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. I hope you can hear me.
Yes,
okay,
it's fine.
I'm calling from Duluth. I just want to know if you've read anything by Eckhart Tolle, and he makes a point that we see ourselves too much in what we do and our accomplishments rather than just being and who we are.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Dawn?
I have not read that, but I have read some other authors who are making the same argument. And, you know, part of the problem here is that we do live in a culture that emphasizes work and making money and what we do. And it's really, really hard to de-emphasize that when you don't have the support of your culture. Certainly there's some work on Israel, for example. Ofer Sharon's work on Israeli people who have lost their jobs and are seeking work, they're not putting quite as much emphasis on the job as who they are. It's just their batch of skills. And I think sometimes in the U.S. we put so much emphasis on it. We put all our eggs in one basket, and then when it goes, and we're left without a balanced identity.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Let's go now to Barbara in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, yes. I am 67 years old. I work 40 hours a week as a professional buyer. I've been doing this work for 20, 25 years, and I've been through job losses about three times in the last, since 2002. The first time it happened, I had a high school senior that I was providing health insurance for, and I was scared out of my mind. But at the last minute, they decided that, no, they needed to keep me, and I was on a roller coaster ride. I didn't know what felt worse, losing the job or getting the job back. And then the second time was in 2008, and that time I was prepared for it. I had already secured other employment, and it was a breeze until that company went through a restructuring, and I was let go again. And at that time, My son had left. I had an empty nest. I had no husband. And I was devastated again, but I went back to school, and I got my skills all updated, and now I'm so happily employed, I can't tell you. I don't even know when I'm going to retire.
Well, thanks so much for that, Barbara, and I want to give Dawn a chance to respond. It sounds like Barbara has kind of built in some resiliency.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds that way. Being prepared, she mentioned, helped her get through that second period of job loss, going back to school and kind of restructuring who she is in some ways. You know, it's interesting because some of the research actually shows that worrying about losing a job can be harder on your physical and mental health than actually losing your job sometime. That uncertainty, you know, at least if you've lost your job, you know, okay, I've lost that. Now I need to move forward. So first of all, Barbara, my apologies to hear about the previous job losses, but congratulations on your new job.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Barbara. And let's stay with our callers and go now to Mary in Dane County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I lost my job when I was about 61. It was during that recession, and I had been there 17 years, and it came out of the blue. I didn't even know it was going to happen, and it was. I still don't think I've recovered, and mentally or financially, I just feel like I don't know. I'm afraid to get a job, and that's terrible. But it's how I feel.
So, Mary, you said it's been about 7 years or so, and so you've been unemployed since that happened.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Dawn, does that echo to things that you heard from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. For one thing, if you're over 40, and certainly if you're over 60, very real age discrimination exists out there. And it makes it very, very hard to move forward and take that chance and put yourself on the line. Several of the people I spoke to talked about trying to put resumes out there and repeatedly just not hearing anything. You know, we're living in a day and age where you don't get a rejection letter, you just hear nothing. It's radio silence. Mm-hmm. And this was really disturbing to them, to the point where they said, I can't do this anymore. I can't put myself on the line anymore.
Before we have to wrap up, I want to make sure we touch on one other aspect. We talked a little bit about the difference for men and women. What about differences between different racial groups? Did you see any difference there?
I did. I spoke with both white and black participants in my study. Black participants overall were more resilient. However, they had some very specific concerns when they would lose their jobs. For one thing, they mentioned that putting themselves on the line was a little bit different in terms of worrying about racial discrimination. For example, worrying that people would think they had lost their job because they'd done something because of their race, or that race would come into the explanation for why they were unemployed, even when that was not the case. Other black participants talked about being worried that if they took a lower-level job, so for example, Janelle was a college-educated online programming manager for a TV station, and she lost her job. She was laid off. It was nothing she did wrong. They were cutting costs. She was offered a job as a product demonstrator at Walmart. You know, the people who hand you some meat or some product to try, some crackers or some jelly or whatever it might be. And they said, well, the products will vary, but, you know, it's a job. So she was offered this job, and she was really concerned that if she took this job that she would sort of confirm the stereotype. But she was about to also lose her apartment. So she was really in this bind. Overall, they were more resilient, and these participants credited that to their parents. They credited that to thinking about how disadvantaged they could be in comparison to where they were.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dawn, thank you so much for joining us. That was Dawn R. Norris, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW La Crosse. She joined us to talk about her book, Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. And you can keep the conversation going about your experiences on the Central Time Facebook page.